From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Detroit Congressman John Conyers says, yes, he paid a settlement in a sexual harassment complaint, but he denies the harassment. We'll hear from the BuzzFeed reporter who broke this story.
The documents that we obtained and reported our story off of included documents that said people had witnessed this behavior, not just against one female staffer, but several.
Eastern Michigan University professors push back against plans to have a for-profit company offer online courses.
It dilutes the quality of courses because students do not have that kind of direct contact with professors that has become the hallmark of an EMU education.
And another step toward letting voters decide whether to legalize pot in Michigan.
Just like with alcohol, prohibition of marijuana has been a massive failure.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up later in this hour, we learn why so many professors at Eastern Michigan University are opposed to the university's partnership with an online education company.
It dilutes the quality of courses because students do not have that kind of direct contact with professors that has become the hallmark of an EMU education.
Plus, Michigan's Cyber Civilian Corps poised to act in case of a major cyber attack.
Let's say a nation state hacked into the power grid and took out power stations in the UP during the winter. That would be pretty awful.
But first, sexual harassment claims are being made today about longtime Detroit Democratic Congressman John Conyers. The 88-year-old is one of the most prominent African Americans on Capitol Hill. Known as the Dean of the House, Conyers first went to Congress in 1964. Among other things, the congressman is alleged to have used taxpayer money to settle a sexual harassment complaint made by a female staffer. Lisandra Villa is one of two BuzzFeed reporters, along with Paul McLeod, who broke this story, and she is with us now via Skype. Lisa, welcome. Now, we're talking about alleged sexual harassment against many female employees?
Yes. So the documents that we obtained and reported our story off of included documents that said people had witnessed this behavior, not just against one female staffer, but several, and not even necessarily in private settings, but also public settings, which is interesting. So, yeah, there were a number of people involved.
And what kinds of behaviors are alleged in these documents you received? And please be specific.
Yep. So the thing about these documents is that they were so wide-ranging. There was a lot to choose from. So one woman in an affidavit talked about being in a car with him, and it was a stick shift. And as she was resting her hand on the stick, she alleged the congressman would start rubbing her hand sexually. There were other incidents of him allegedly pressuring women to stay in his hotel room with him. And the women alleged that he would ask them to stay in the hotel room, and when they wouldn't, he would say things like, cuddle up to me before you go, or try to find me a woman that'll come. So a lot of requests for sexual acts, I guess is an all-encompassing term, were alleged in these documents.
And as I'm reading your story, rubbing legs and backs and
yes,
asking for intimate touching.
Yes, there was one affidavit that talked about how one staffer's duties, she said, were to keep a list that she believed of women that she believed the congressman was having an affair with, and at times even having them flown in using congressional resources, which was, like I said, there was so much in these documents.
Your story reports on a wrongful dismissal complaint and settlement with a woman who once worked for Congressman Conyers. What is she saying?
That former employee was the center of this settlement, and she essentially said that she was wrongfully dismissed because she wouldn't, quote, succumb to his sexual advances. So part of the settlement, and again, the congressman didn't admit wrongdoing through the settlement. Basically, the deal ended up being that she would be rehired for a period, but she wouldn't go into the office. This was just a matter of having her be on the payroll to pay the settlement money.
And how much of that? How much was the settlement?
That was more than $27,000.
All right. So, and the settlement money came from
his office.
Taxpayer
money, yeah.
In the end, Lisa, how many unnamed sources did you speak with to confirm this story?
we had four signed affidavits, and then, oh gosh, four people involved with the case verified that the documents were authentic. For their privacy, we, of course, withheld their names.
Right, right. And you reported that you received these documents from Mike Cernovich, who, as you note in your piece, a pro-Trump media activist. Many label him alt-right. He was the one who was pushing the Pizzagate conspiracy theory about Hillary Clinton. Considering this source, what did it take for you to come to trust these documents?
The hardest part about this was making sure, of course, verifying them. So we had to do so many checks and make a lot of calls and make sure that we were rock solid. These documents came from Mike Cernovich, but we independently vetted everything. Paul and I spent the weekend reading through them very carefully, looking for the slightest giveaway that, you know, maybe these weren't authentic. But ultimately, they were, and we were able to move forward after verifying with several people.
And you are finally able to report on a statement from Congressman Conyers. What is he saying about your story?
Yes, he essentially said that he does deny all of the allegations. And he said, this is actually a quote because I have it right in front of me, quote, "My office resolved the allegations with an express denial of liability in order to save all involved from the rigors of protracted litigation. That should not be lost in the narrative." And so yeah, again, he denies the allegations, but he does confirm the settlement.
And this takes us, this whole story that you're offering everybody this morning on BuzzFeed, takes us right to the way Congress handles sexual harassment complaints, to the Office of Compliance, because there is no Human Resources Office on Capitol Hill?
That's right. So this is something that members, no matter which party you belong to, members recognize that Congress is just a very unique situation, and which is why, especially in the post-Weinstein era, there's just been a lot of talk about how to deal with this on the Hill. So basically the way that the Office of Compliance complaint process works is you have 180 days to report an incident. And then after that, you go to mandatory counseling, which can take up to 30 days after you report the incident. That can be waived, the counseling can. But if you move beyond the counseling to anything else, at some point, you'll have to sign a confidentiality agreement, which is what people aren't liking about the system, because they're saying that if a settlement does come to be made, then the victims don't have a chance to speak out, warn other people, and the harasser just gets to keep doing what they're doing and kind of get away with it without anybody really knowing, just because it was settled quietly.
Meaning the next person who steps in to walk in that office would conceivably have no idea of past history.
Yep. So that's actually what one of the people in our story said, was something along the lines of they don't think it should be a secret settlement, precisely because it doesn't warn the next woman or the next person going into those situations. So,
and also it hits me that the secret of process means we don't have any idea of how many sexual harassment allegations have been settled, because there are other kinds of human resources complaints that could be filed. So we don't really have an idea of the scope of the sexual harassment problem on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, that could be true. So we are missing a lot of details on that, it appears. So the Washington Post, and we included this in the story, had reported that the Office of Compliance paid out $17 million for 264 settlements over 20 years. And the thing about that figure is that those weren't all sexual harassment cases. And then based on our reporting, the money that this particular settlement was paid out of was the office's account, and not this Office of Compliance account. So it's just, there are a lot of questions left there.
And certainly, as you say, in the post-Weinstein era, there's a lot of members of Congress are taking a very hard look at this process. And you list in your story a number of complaints that they have about this process. So we'll have to keep an eye on that. But the idea of this ghost payroll, paying people who don't show up for work, are you very satisfied that that is how this employee was paid off?
Yes, that's how the settlement was set up, so that the employee didn't have to, wasn't actually doing the job, was just put back on the payroll for a few months to pay out the settlement money, but no work was actually done to compensate for that. And again, as you noted, that was taxpayer money.
And finally, what are you hearing from the congressman's colleagues in the House?
Yep. So I've actually started reaching out, especially to his judiciary colleagues. Starting to hear a couple of people start to say that he should be investigated. So we haven't heard anything from House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi at this point. And we have put out a request there, of course, just post-publication. Speaker Ryan did put out a statement and said that this was troubling. But his statement went into how he's called for some reforms in the House, too.
And you do note in your story that a staffer said to you, your story won't do bleep to him. He's untouchable. He is a powerful member of the House.
He is a powerful member of the House. I guess we'll have to see. And it's also an interesting week for this story to come out just because everyone happens to be gone for Thanksgiving recess. So right now, you know, I'm normally on Capitol Hill reporting from there, but we're at the Bureau because none of the lawmakers are there right now. So it'll be interesting to see what comes of this in the following days, but also once they return to Washington.
Lisa Villa with BuzzFeed. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Lisa.
Thank you for your time.
And since that conversation, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi has called for a House Ethics Committee investigation into Congressman Conyers over these allegations, as has the Michigan Democratic Party. There is so much to talk about in this diverse state of ours. We cannot possibly know about all of it, which is where you come in. We want to know what you're curious about. If you have a question about something in Michigan or someone you've always wondered about, it's easy to send it along. Just go to the Am I Curious page at michiganradio.org. Coming up, new music from Detroit area artists, and we have a special theme going this week.
Yeah, this time we decided that we would take a look at three women artists that we love and adore.
And then Michigan, one big step closer to voting on legalizing marijuana.
Just like with alcohol, prohibition of marijuana has been a massive failure.
That comes up in 20 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Think for just a moment of what a cyber attack would mean for business, for government, for healthcare systems, in our personal lives. We couldn't function without the internet, which is why Governor Snyder recently signed a law creating the Michigan Cyber Civilian Corps. Think of it as a volunteer fire brigade ready to be called up in the event of a cyber attack or other internet threat. Here with us now is Ray Davidson, Program Director of MIC3, the Michigan Cyber Civilian Corps. It's good to have you with us, Ray.
Thanks for having me.
So the Corps consists of volunteers?
That's correct.
Who are they? What are their backgrounds?
For people that want to be members of the Corps, we ask for people that are active in incident response and computer security. They'll have a year or two of active experience working in network administration, security administration. We ask for people to have a base security certification and to be really interested in donating perhaps 10 days per year of their time to assist with mostly in training activities.
How many do you have so far?
We have just over 70 people that have been invited to be part of the Corps.
So you're reaching out, that you're doing the recruiting, you're kind of identifying people, but are you hearing from people as well?
We are. And for people that are listening, if they are interested, you can find that information at our website, which is micybercorps.org. That gives information about the Corps. It also talks about the requirements for being a member.
What's the mission?
Right now, it is to respond in the event of a governor-declared cyber emergency. We'd like, though, to be able to expand that, to be able to respond to incidents that are of a lower level than that. When a governor-declared cyber emergency, according to the Michigan Cyber Response Plan, is something that threatens life and limb.
So, for instance?
Well, let's say a nation state hacked into the power grid and took out power stations in the UP during the winter. That would be pretty awful. We hope that that never happens. But we have at least 70 volunteers now, and we don't want them sitting on their hands doing nothing. We want to have some benefit from this. So we're looking to be able to respond to things that are sort of a lower level of severity, as well as perhaps be able to do some proactive activities. It's no good to just be reactive, right? If we're all lucky, none of this will ever happen.
So when you say lower level, would that be something where a business has a problem and can call for help? How do you see these lower level activity issues?
Well, that's a very good question. If you read the Michigan Cyber Civilian Act that was just passed, we are required to publish standards by which people can ask for assistance. And with only 70 people working as volunteers, we don't want to get overwhelmed. We need to make sure that we have a prioritization. I'm sure that we're going to be concentrating on things that would be critical infrastructure, say healthcare, education, local and regional governments. So, with respect to retail establishments, I'm sorry, but, that's probably not going to be where we put our efforts.
But cities or communities. And what is it you would actually be able to do, you and the members of the Corps?
There again, we are determining the limits. We coordinate very closely with the Michigan State Police and also the National Guard. We're looking at their processes that they already have in place. We are not law enforcement, and we don't want to be confused with that.
Are you there to put out the fire?
Right, exactly. We're there to put out the fire and to do a little investigation, triage, if you will, in the medical term. We want to find out, to whatever extent we can, what happened and what we can do now. We're not going to rebuild the house, though. Some people have expressed some concerns about competing with existing businesses. And there are security companies in Michigan that do a very good job. We're not intending to compete with that. We're intending instead to go in, figure out what went wrong, and perhaps we could give the initial report to those folks.
And then it can be up to, like you say, the state police or whomever else to start to figure out what to do about who caused it.
That's right.
You're not there to do that. What does the law that the governor recently signed do toward protecting your team from lawsuits?
We are covered by essentially a Good Samaritan type arrangement. I'm not a lawyer and I don't play one on TV, but I will say that as long as we are doing our best, we're indemnified so that we're not subject to lawsuit. We, as the Cyber Civilian Corps, have standards. And that is one of the things that we have on our website, in fact, is the requirements to be a member. You have to pass some tests. So we're doing our diligence to say the people that work with us are qualified to be doing what they're doing, and we always act in good faith. So it's like if somebody's pulled over to the side of the road and they try to help and something goes wrong, but they were trying to do their best, like a medical student,
exactly.
It's not...
They're protected.
Right.
Good Samaritan protected.
Yes, exactly.
Got that. You talked about another level of activity you hope to see. I kind of get the sense of public education or outreach, prevention techniques.
It could be. That's something we're thinking about because I hope all of your listeners know that October is National Cybersecurity Awareness Month, and that's, right, maybe they don't know that. And I hope that people change their passwords more frequently than once a year in October. But there's a lot of information out there like change your passwords, like don't use the same password on websites, that sort of thing, which is, I don't want to say it's common knowledge, but it's commonly communicated. For the people with the technical expertise being on the Cyber Civilian Corps, we're hoping to get contact with businesses or sort of larger groups, not to do the end user kind of education, though everybody should know. And I think one of the advantages of having the Cyber Civilian Corps is that as we collect a group of people and try and train them, and they go back to their employers and their families, it will raise the security culture throughout the state.
That's true. Sending out missionaries, if you will.
Right.
Why do you and your members feel that this is worth your time, worth your talents? What do you get personally from this?
Well, there is a sense of civic duty or civic reward. Not so much duty. Duty implies sort of that one has to, but the kind of people that are on the Cyber Civilian Corps are the kind of people that have computer labs in their basement. They spend extra time doing this. They may do it for their regular job, but they like it so much that they'll go play with stuff after hours. And we've created a community. And I see a lot of conversations, the professionals asking each other for help. We're installing this kind of system. What have you done? What kind of issues do you have? Not proprietary, of course, but this is a fairly limited or esoteric subject matter. these are the kind of people that, you know, you go to work and nobody laughs at your jokes because they're not watching the same TV shows that you are, you know. So this gives us a way to create a sort of a virtual community, as well as the MIC3 provides training. And this is training that most employers won't provide. It's fairly specialized, so it's difficult for employers to do it. We band together, and so we get a special dispensation from the provider. In return for that, the state requires the members who take the training to take the exam. So if there is a way of showing that they've achieved the learning, we require that. This is so that the state will have some evidence of return on the investment they're making. I really think it's a win-win-win.
For anyone who spends those late nights in the dark basement doing the same kinds of things you're talking about, who might want to join the Michigan Cyber Civilian Corps, what's that website again?
The website is MI Cyber Corps. That's MICYBERCORPS.org.
All right. Well, Ray Davidson is Program Director of MIC3, the Michigan Cyber Civilian Corps. Thanks for sharing your work with us, Ray.
Thanks for having me.
Time for us to listen to some new music from Detroit area artists. Our guides, as always, are Paul Young, founder and publisher of Detroit Music Magazine, and executive editor Khaled Bahti. Welcome back to both of you. And Khaled, there's a kind of a theme you've set up for this time around, which is?
Yeah, this time we decided that we would take a look at three women artists that we love and adore.
All right, so we're going to start with a Detroit rapper who's actually moved out of working at a Chrysler plant and is making her mark in the world of hip-hop. Paul, tell us about her.
Yeah, Deja Loaf. She's become, more than a household name in the Detroit area. She's certainly, gone on to do big national things. She signed a major record deal. And so she really hit the scene majorly in with her Self Soul 2014 mixtape and the track Try Me, which, blew up. And there was all kinds of remixes and that kind of thing. She also put out an EP in 2015, and she had a new mixtape in 2016. We're still waiting on her album, Liberated, and she previously released a track called No Fear. But the one we're going to hear today is called Changes. Funny how they said that they wanted back then. Once I got it, girl, till I disappear. How you carry yourself, how you speak within. Anything negative just ain't part of my plan. God chose me, and I'll be goddamn if I let another soul try to will me in. If it was meant to be. That is some really, really great production. I feel kind of like mixing some old school polish with some hip hop. Yeah, the production is by Ricky Reed, and it really sounds like a Just Blaze type production with those rolling drums and those really rich kind of royal brass horn sounds. Yeah, super highly produced and certainly less R&B and more the rap that we're used to hearing.
I'm just wondering what led to her break and to getting that recording deal with Columbia.
In 2014, she put out Try Me, and it caught the attention of Drake on Instagram, and he gave it a shout out. And then all of these other artists put out their own unauthorized versions. Some of them were authorized, and it became a sleeper hit that summer, and that led to a deal with Columbia. She put out another mixtape. The rest is history.
Boy, it's just a case of when the right person hears your music, and Drake is the right
Drake
person.
Drake cosign will get you places.
That's indeed. Over to someone who's a familiar name to Detroit music fans, Anna Birch. And Khaled, tell us why we know her.
Anna Birch should be familiar to anyone who follows local music, especially the indie rock circles. She has been a singer with Frontier Ruckus, the folk rock group, who have made a splash recently. She's been a member of Veiled Flowers. She's one of the co-front people. She's also released a split cassette tape recently with Steph Chura, who put out Messes earlier this year. So she's quite a name in local circles.
And as with groups, but now she's got a solo recording deal?
Right. She just recently signed to Polyvinyl, which is a major indie. Mm-hmm. It's kind of contradiction, but she just got a solo deal with them.
Let's take a listen to this new single, Too Cool to Care, Anna Birch. Slamming on
all your drinks, you don't have to think about me. You've got all your friends, used up all their meds, honey. I'll still be okay when you walk my way publicly. But when I get home, I can't be alone, can't you see? You scare me with your indifference.
Can you talk about her lo-fi sound? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, lo-fi means low fidelity. It was really popular, especially in the 90s, with bands like Guided by Voices, Sebado. But what she does with this is that she puts a sort of girl group spin on it, especially when the time signature changes at the bridge, and then in the chorus, too. It's sweet, it's harmonious, dulcet, sort of chiming guitars, reverb heavy. But then if you listen to the lyrics, it's about pining for someone who's not really going to return those feelings. It's unrequited love, that juxtaposition of wanting something you can't have, but having these really sweet and wholesome sounds is really interesting.
So we haven't got an album out yet, so waiting for that to drop.
Right, it's coming soon.
All right, and she just wrapped up her latest tour, so we'll have to wait for a chance to see Anna Birch. But not so with our final artist, Rebecca Goldberg. There's a totally different sound from the other two coming from this Detroit-based DJ. Paul, tell us about her.
No doubt, yeah, very very much so in contrast with Anna Birch. But she's been around for a little while. She's done residences for local clubs. She had a live air performance, like reoccurring performance called Sunday Sessions for WDET 101.9. And she played Movement in 2016. She was at the Opportunity Detroit stage, which is very cool. She had an EP accompaniment last year that came out for a 1902 silent film. A lot of people are probably familiar with it. It's called The Trip to the Moon. And so her EP like lines up with that perfectly. And then another one she released last year was called 313 Acid Queen. It's really just paying tribute to that acid techno sound, lots of 808s, lots of 909s. And she really does pay homage to a lot of the pioneers of that classic Detroit techno sound, a lot of repetition.
And just explain for those who maybe aren't real familiar, when you talk about 808s and 303s, what does that mean?
Yeah, those are just those are basically just drums, synthetic drums, and those are just really popular sounds that a lot of the pioneers has been using. 808 certainly is something that's appeared in different genres of music. These are used in hip hop and kind of all over the place, drum and bass. But techno really relied on some of these kind of antiquated and very early synthesizer and electronic technology. So 808s, 909s, those are probably the big ones.
Khaled, how out there at the forefront of techno music is Rebecca Goldberg?
I think she's certainly someone who prides herself on that spirit of discovery, which is something that you could trace back to her roots growing up in an era where the internet was in its nascent stages. And so you didn't have streaming services all over the place. So when you found new music, it was, you know, a true discovery. You were stumbling upon things that you heard on terrestrial radio, that someone introduced you to on a mixtape. And that serendipitous sort of feeling of finding something that on a white label, you know, what is that? Where did you find that? It's something that kind of is gone by the wayside because it's everything's available all the time on demand. And I think that spirit is alive in her music. And if you listen to this mix, which is about 32 minutes long, it opens with something that's not four-on-the-floor house. It's not a mechanical techno beat. It's almost leads you to believe it's going to be pure experimentation. And then it goes on for the vast majority of it as pretty standard techno fare, and it's really exciting and interesting. Then it closes with this blast of psychedelic, acid rock, funk. I just found that to be really exciting because you don't expect that at the end. You kind of expect it to end with this flourish of a climax of techno fare, but it's not.
that is truly, truly representing Detroit's techno scene. And you can actually catch her in some shows that are coming up this week. I know that Rebecca Goldberg will be playing this Friday at Marble Bar in Detroit, this Saturday at the Necto in Detroit, and then what a great big show on New Year's Eve with Matthew Dear and others at Marble Bar. So people can get in on that and find out more information by going to Detroit Music Magazine.
As always.
As always. You can learn all about today's featured artist and many, many more by going to DetroitMusicMag.com. And as always, our guides for our excursions into Detroit music remain Paul Young, founder and publisher of Detroit Music Magazine, and its executive editor, Khaled Badi. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Cynthia.
Thanks, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Still to come, Eastern Michigan University professors push back against plans to have a for-profit company market online courses at EMU in exchange for half the tuition. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The effort to legalize recreational use of marijuana in Michigan hit a crucial milestone yesterday when more than 360,000 signatures were delivered by truck to the Board of State Canvassers. If the panel validates most of these signatures, the measure could either go on the 2018 ballot or be taken up by the legislature. Joining us is Josh Hovey. He's with the Lansing PR firm Truscott Rosman and is the communications director for the Coalition to Regulate Marijuana Like Alcohol. It's one of the groups that's been leading this effort. So now you move into the campaigning phase. Josh, what will be your message to voters?
Our main message to voters is that, just like with alcohol, prohibition of marijuana has been a massive failure. We think that what we're proposing, which is a tightly regulated system that will bring tax revenue into the state, is a much smarter approach. It'll stop the waste of law enforcement resources on petty things like minor possession issues and things like that, where they can refocus their efforts on things like the opiate epidemic or violent crime. And, you know, we're going to be generating hundreds of millions of tax revenue for the state of Michigan. It's going to go towards roads, public schools, and local governments, which every year that Lansing is doing its budget at the Capitol, those are some of the most pressing issues that always seem to get shorted. So we think we can solve a problem for the state. We can end the waste of law enforcement resources and give people some personal freedoms to do what they're honestly already doing and make sure that they're using it responsibly.
Now, I know the campaign kind of ran low on funds toward the end of the signature collection phase. How will the messaging and campaigning be funded moving forward?
You know, it comes down to, I think, just talking to voters and communicating them about the issue. And we are lucky to have groups like the Marijuana Policy Project, which is a leading advocacy organization in D.C., as well as the National Cannabis Industry Association, which advocates for responsible business practices when it comes to marijuana businesses. So that gives us a national reach, but at the same time, we've done very well with collecting small dollar donations from around the state through online fundraising. So we'll be doing a combination of both and putting all those resources together to make sure that voters have the facts on the issue, because I think when they do have the facts, the only option they'll choose is to vote yes.
What kind of political opposition are you expecting?
You know, it's hard to say. We're probably going to be one of the few states to have a legalization measure on the ballot next year. So there'll probably be a pretty intense spotlight on Michigan from a national perspective that could bring dollars both for and against the issue. What we saw in Arizona was makers of certain opiate drugs, actually the pharmaceutical manufacturers of those drugs, funded an opposition campaign to legalization. So we are expecting that as a very real possibility in 2018, and we'll be fundraising like mad to make sure that the myths are busted and the facts are out there.
You far exceeded the number of necessary signatures. You needed 252,000. You turned in over 360,000 signatures. When do you expect the Board of Canvassers to rule?
You know, the state's got to do its work to verify that our signatures are correct and then schedule a Board of Canvassers meeting. And, you know, given that we're into the holiday season, that might not happen until sometime in January. But we're 99% confident that our work will be verified and that we'll be on the ballot.
Josh Hovey with the Coalition to Regulate Marijuana Like Alcohol. Josh, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Cynthia.
Colleges and universities are seeking ways to reach more students and bring in more money. And one way to do that hire an outside company to market and support online programs. The company recruits students for online degrees that are branded with the name of that university. Among universities in our state, Michigan Tech and MSU have arrangements like this for some classes. Professors at Eastern Michigan University, however, are pushing back against such an arrangement between EMU and a for-profit company called Academic Partnerships. Judith Kullberg is professor of political science at EMU, and she's president of the EMU branch of the American Association of University Professors, and she is with us now. Good to have you here, Judith.
I'm happy to be here.
So your position is that the university's contract with this company out of Texas, Academic Partnerships, would devalue a degree from EMU. Why do you believe that?
Well, we've learned that Academic Partnerships has a model of instruction that involves scaling up courses so that they become very large. So either a course has no caps on it at all in terms of enrollment, or multiple sections of a course will be created from one section. And then the professor is supported in working with the students by another category of workers that Academic Partnerships refers to as coaches or teaching assistants. And these coaches or teaching assistants are not employees of the institution. They are provided by another for-profit company called Instructional Connections that is a strategic partner of Academic Partnerships. And both companies are located in Dallas, Texas. They're both private firms. And so they obviously developed this way of what they would say supporting instructors in teaching online. But our view of it is that it dilutes the quality of courses because students do not have that kind of direct contact with professors that has become the hallmark of an EMU education.
How does that differ, just talking in general, with having teaching assistants teaching large sections, even if it's in front of them, not online? How does that any different?
I think it's quite different. Even though Instructional Connections, if you look at their website, they explain that the way the firm was created was by thinking about, well, how do large research universities teach so many students and do it fairly efficiently? They have this model of teaching assistant. But the big difference here is that teaching assistants in a research university are students at that university. They're enrolled in graduate programs, and really they are in a kind of apprenticeship system where they're working with a senior professor who designs the course and delivers the lectures, and then that senior professor coordinates the kinds of discussions that will take place in the classroom between the teaching assistants and the students. So the teaching assistants have face-to-face interaction with the students, they get to know the students, and they are learning how to teach in the process. And they will, when they finish their degrees, will go off and take academic positions at other universities. These teaching assistants that are hired by Instructional Connections,
the coaches
or
yes,
teaching assistants, are very poorly paid. We know that from comments that we've seen online at Glassdoor.com, where employees of Instructional Connections have talked about their working conditions. They are interacting with hundreds of students, maybe thousands of students. They don't have any role in designing the classes or even in their own sections. And they're not graduate students. They aren't people who have been admitted to very prestigious graduate program because they're very bright and did really well in college. We don't even know what their qualifications are to be coaches.
Now, Eastern's statement has been very clear that they say there will be no use of coaches to teach these classes. Are you not buying that?
No, not at all.
Why?
Well, we submitted an information request that we have a right to under state law because we're a collective bargaining unit. The university refused our information request for months. We had to file an unfair labor practice, and an administrative law judge ordered the university to give us the documents we were seeking. The university gave us about 14,000 documents, and we've gone through all of them now, and we have found evidence that the university agreed to the coach model when it signed this current contract.
Much has been written across the country about the future of higher education moving more online. You know, and online classes do offer a chance for more non-traditional students to get a college degree, and they expand the reach of the university because there are no geographic limitations. Are you and your members opposed to offering online classes in general?
No, not at all, because, in fact, I teach an online class. I'm teaching it right now, but it has 25 students in it, and I'm the one teaching those students. I interact with them. I evaluate their work. So even though I don't see them face-to-face, I feel like I know them very well. I certainly, you know, give them a kind of feedback, constructive feedback on the written work that they need, you know, very detailed commentary and advice for how to revise their work. So it's not online instruction itself that we are opposed to, not at all.
Are there other private companies, apart from academic partnerships, that are offering a model that you feel could be workable?
Absolutely.
What does it look like?
Well, we know that several other firms did approach Eastern and explicitly compared their model to the academic partnerships model and said to EMU administrators, why don't you work with us? Because we don't try to tell the university who they should admit, how the courses should be structured, what the term of instruction should be. So these other firms allow the university to remain in control, really, of the curriculum, the content of the curriculum, the structure, admission requirements, everything. Academic Partnerships is a very different kind of firm. It has its own model, and it insists that its partners adhere to its model.
And so let's talk about who shapes the curriculum.
Well, they take a big role in it. So they try to remove all of what they consider to be impediments to student success or even impediments to admission. So the first of those is admission. So it's obviously a lot easier to recruit students if the admissions requirements are lower. And for these online degree programs that my university is currently contracted for, the admissions requirements have been dropped.
I mean, are there no admissions or have they been lowered?
They've been lowered.
How low?
Well, I don't have the documents right in front of me. And, you know, so, I mean, we've just looked at those things a couple of days ago, but it's considerably lower. And there was a lot of opposition within the university, among administrators even, to doing that.
And then what about the content, the actual curriculum? Do they shape that too, or
I would say that they do. In a couple of examples of degree programs that I know quite a bit about, Academic Partnerships said there shouldn't be prereqs for courses. So, you know, a lot of curriculums have the structure where
You have to take this to take that.
Exactly. Sure. You work your way up. You have to have a basic course. It gives you that foundational knowledge, and then you're ready to take the more advanced course, et cetera. Academic Partnerships doesn't want a structure like that because they want students to be able to come in and out of courses whenever they're ready to take classes. They also have a model that they call a carousel, and it involves dividing the academic year up into at least 6 different terms of 6 weeks or 7 weeks in length. And the student can start the curriculum at any time of the year, leave for a semester or a term or two, and then come back in. And any courses that they need, they can always be able to get into them. Many faculty are skeptical about offering courses in such a short format. For some classes, it works. But for other classes, it might not work very well at all. Maybe you really need the 14 weeks. And those things have really traditionally been the responsibility of faculty and departments. This is, I think, the biggest problem of universities working with for-profit entities is that the interests of the university and the interests of the for-profit company diverge.
Are your members worried about losing their jobs because of this kind of arrangement?
No, I don't think we're worried about losing our jobs. What we're really worried about is that this will transform Eastern. Eastern is a university that provides a very high quality education at an affordable price, and we pride ourselves as being an institution of opportunity, and we're worried that this agreement will destroy the qualities of the university that we value so highly.
I'm wondering, once a professor uploads his or her lectures and syllabi and assignments and other course material, who owns that?
Well, that's a really good question. And we're very concerned about that because once a course is created digitally, it can be copied very easily. And we believe that under Michigan state labor law, the university had an obligation to negotiate this agreement about this agreement with us, because this agreement has tremendous implications for our working conditions. And they didn't negotiate. They didn't tell us anything about it. They signed the contract without any consultation with faculty at all.
When was faculty brought into this conversation?
Never. I mean, we've insisted on talking about it, but no, there is no real conversation. They made the decision. They've told us that they're going to go ahead with this.
And if you had been brought into that discussion sooner, how do you think things would be different today?
It would be very different. And that really is what should have happened. If the university believes that this is necessary for its financial well-being and so that it can adapt to the demands of the 21st century, then that should have been considered through a broad conversation that involved all the stakeholders within the university, not just faculty, but students, alumni, people who are concerned about the university, people that support the university. And then there should have been some sort of evaluation of the different models offered by the companies out there. And not all of those companies are for-profit. Some of them are nonprofits. So this company, Academic Partnerships, will get 50% of all tuition and fees for the students that it recruits into the degree programs. That's a lot of money. And here we are in a situation where the state is constantly cutting its budgetary allocations to state universities. And can we really afford to be giving away that much of our revenue?
But the university would argue, well, we wouldn't have these students if they hadn't recruited them.
Well, that's not entirely clear. There have been universities that have ended their agreements with Academic Partnerships because they found that they weren't generating the kind of revenue that Academic Partnerships had said they would, or they had real problems with the quality of the education that was being provided to the students through Academic Partnerships. So Ohio University ended a contract that it was in with Academic Partnerships.
So you've started this ad campaign to raise awareness of what's going on. What are you hoping the end result of that would be?
Well, we're asking that the university honor our collective bargaining agreement, our contract with them, and also that they honor the rights of faculty to give input on curricular matters that are in that contract. So we would like them to bring it to us and ask us what we think about it. And then they really need to negotiate any kind of long-term agreement like this about the delivery of courses with the AAUP.
Is this something that professors would be willing to strike over?
I haven't heard anyone talk about a strike, but I do know that people are very upset. And we have a petition that we've launched online. And it's not just for professors. Anyone can sign it. Anyone that's worried about Eastern Michigan's future can sign that petition. And there are people who would like to speak with the administration about this whole situation, would like to have some answers to the questions that we've posed. So that might be possible, that we could organize some sort of a forum where the administration would really have to answer these questions, and that would be good, too. But no, I haven't heard anything about a strike.
Judith Kohlberg is president of the Eastern Michigan University Board of the American Association of University Professors. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Cynthia.
And we reached out to EMU's administration and invited them to join us to share their perspective. They have accepted our invitation, and we'll have that conversation for you within the next 2 weeks. We also reached out to a representative of Academic Partnerships involved in negotiating the deal with EMU. That person did not respond to our request for an interview. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Rusty Brock. Stateside's executive producer is Joel Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.